Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy, squeezing your brain, messing with your mind, and just maybe challenging your grip on that amorphous and elusive concept known as reality. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp. I'm your host, your trail guide, your designated driver of the airwaves, at least for the next few hours. Thanks for staying up late to be with us tonight, or if you're listening to a stream link of the show, thanks for taking time out of your day to check in with us. I'm very confident we're going to make it worth your time. Good stuff coming up in this program. You know, for a couple of months, I've been telling you about this incident along the Colorado River. Something fell from the sky back in May and was quickly scooped up by helicopters. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we're going to be joined by two of the principal witnesses in that UFO crash case, ex-cop Frank Costigan and the guy known affectionately here as Houseboat Bob, or Bob on the River, who dropped out of sight for a while. We tried to have him on the program a couple of months ago, as you'll recall, and weren't able to pull that off, but he'll be here tonight. Also, I'll tell you about these Men in Black type agency folks that we encountered down there outside of Needles, California. I've been kind of teasing you about that for a while. Those of you who've been waiting to hear about that agency, the wait's about to end. And coming up at the top of the second hour, I'll be joined by historian and UFO author Richard Dolan. And I have an admission to make. You know, I didn't realize that Rich Dolan had been on the program with George Norrie earlier this month, just, 10 days ago or so. That show was broadcast from here in Las Vegas. And I know that George had several of the speakers from the crash retrieval conference on the program for like 30 minutes each. I didn't get to hear the show. So when I asked the Coast producers to invite Rich Dolan on to join me, I didn't know he'd just been on. But I promise you, we have a lot of ground to cover, and this will not be repetitive at all. I had the pleasure of chatting with Mr. Dolan at the Las Vegas conference. We got into some really heavy stuff about disclosure, whether President-elect Obama might spill some beans about UFOs, or whether he will even be informed himself by, for lack of a better term, the keepers of the secrets. And I thought tonight we could talk about disclosure, whether it's a good idea, who would do it, how it would work, and how we might react. And in that same vein about UFO secrecy and government cover-up, I heard a theory from Rich Dolan about why government agencies jumped into this disinformation game, late 70s, early 80s, purposely spreading lies and bad information, spying on UFO groups, compiling dossiers on UFO researchers. And he's got a new take on that that I think will be one of those aha moments for you, as it was for me. Anyway, I think he's one of the brightest minds and most honest researchers in the field, and he brings an historian's appreciation for the tiny details to the UFO subject, and I can't wait to get into it with him. First things first, though. Listeners will recall that during several programs that I've hosted over the past year, we've talked about the situation with America's wild horse herds, and it's pretty bad. And now it's even worse. A little recap for you. Since the early 1970s, wild horses and burros in this country have been protected. The American public spoke. We passed this Wild Horse and Burro Act in, I think, 1971. And the American people decided that these animals have a special place in our history and our culture, and they need to be preserved out in the wild. So the government created 300 of these HMAs, these horse management areas, encompassing millions of acres of public land. They're set aside for the horses. And about half the nation's wild horses live on ranges here in Nevada, about 30,000 of them. Well, here's what's been happening over the past couple of years. And if you've heard some of my earlier broadcasts about this, you got a general idea. About 40% of these horses have been rounded up in the last couple of years, snatched off the ranges, thrown into government corrals, and there are now more horses in captivity than there are out there on the public ranges. BLM, which is the agency that runs this program, it doesn't even pretend anymore that this is being done for the good of the horses. You know, these horses are not starving. They're not dying of thirst. They're thriving out on the range. The last several roundups that have been taking place here in Nevada were explained by BLM that they're rounding them up so that they don't starve in the future. They're fine now, but we think they might starve and be in trouble in the future. Although they don't even pretend to do any actual range science in making these determinations and predictions, they just simply do it. Of the 300 HMAs, horse management areas, that have been set aside for horses, 100 of them have now been completely zeroed out. That is, there are no horses in them anymore. Those same areas that supposedly were too stressed for the horses, not enough water or forage, they now have sheep and cattle grazing on them since, you know, ranchers pay grazing fees to the feds. Horses don't pay anything, and nor are they a game animal to be hunted for sport. I suppose if you could go out and shoot a horse and put its head on your wall somewhere, that horses would be protected, but they're not. You know, BLM keeps gathering and gathering these horses, spending millions of dollars a year on more roundups, and it puts almost nothing, a mere pittance, into these programs to adopt the horses out, which is what the law calls them to do. There are some exceptions to that, of course, but some things that they do just for window dressing or good PR, but in general, this adoption stuff is an utter failure. So the horses get crowded into these pens. It costs a lot of money, your money, my money, to take care of them. Just a few weeks ago, BLM announced it can no longer afford to care for the horses. They're going to have to put them down. They would either kill them with a bullet or a bolt to the head, or they would sell them off en masse to, which means that they would probably go to slaughterhouses to be cut up into horse meat steaks. Essentially, BLM has done all this systematically over the past couple of years, and now it finds itself with all these horses, and it's kind of shrugging its shoulders like, hey, where'd all these horses come from? You know, when it did it. You know, the Bureau drove this train off the track and into the ditch, and now it's asking, hey, we're stuck in this ditch. How'd we get here? Last week, there was this disturbing report put out by the GAO. It used to be the General Accounting Office. Now it's called the Government Accountability Office, in which GAO agreed that the BLM needs the authority to move forward with mass euthanizations of horses, since it's just too expensive to keep them around anymore. And this was like a punch in the stomach to all these wild horse groups who've tried to lobby BLM to do more to adopt the horses out or to institute birth control measures or, as a last resort, let the horses back out on the ranges that are set aside for them, to fend for themselves. It doesn't cost anything to feed a wild horse that's left in the wild. Well, tomorrow, that is November 16th, in Reno, Nevada, the National Wild Horse and Burro Advisory Commission will meet to talk about this GAO report. And given the makeup of this commission, it seems unlikely it's going to go against the BLM or the GAO. So, you know, we could start seeing very soon the deaths of these wild horses sooner than anyone might want to admit. Or maybe we won't see them. Maybe it'll happen in the dead of night. They'll just ship them off to Mexico in a truck to become horse burgers or dog food or both. If you are at all interested in this issue, you might want to send an email to a couple of places, to President-elect Obama, for one. You know, wild horse groups are hoping that the BLM will at least hold off until a new administration's in place before any drastic decisions are made. Let somebody else make that decision. There are some wild horse groups that we've highlighted in the past on this program. I think there are some links on Coast's website still from those shows. We had a guy named Jerry Reynoldson on the program last month. There's also a group called the Cloud Foundation in Colorado. They do a lot of work with a singer, Sheryl Crow, who was in Las Vegas this week and sought us out and wanted an interview because she's upset and worried about what decisions might be made at this Wild Horse Advisory Commission meeting on Monday. So if this is an issue that tugs at your heart or interests you at all, you might want to give it some thought. It's about more than just horses. It's about our public lands and our public money and how they're managed and who they really belong to. You know, I mention this because so many of the Coast listeners have responded to the story in the past when we've talked about it on the program, so I thought you'd want to know where it stands. We're going to take a short break, get to a couple of other news items, and then talk to Frank Costigan and Houseboat Bob. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. My name is George Knapp. Thanks for being with us here for this program. A couple of news items. This one is from Brazil, a writer and publisher down there, friend of the program, A.J. Gavard. Reports that Brazil just experienced its first ever crop formations. There were two of them spotted on November 9th in the state of Santa Catarina. Witnesses also reported seeing weird lights, I guess, in the sky just prior to the formations being discovered. These are kind of big ones, too. Not quite as geometrically dramatic as some of the ones seen in England, but pretty cool anyway. Analysis is underway. And we got some pictures in the link on the Coast to Coast site if you want to take a peek. While you're there, you might want to check out another item posted by Webmaster Lex. Someone had sent this thing to me. The title is In Honor of Aliens, and it's about an artist who's designing the floor tiles that'll be used at the future Raelian Embassy. You know about the Raelians, right? Their prophet is a man named Rael, who teaches that humans were genetically engineered by ETs. We might have to get Rael on the program sometime, by the way. He's an interesting man, for sure. Whether you agree with his take on religion or not, anyway, take a look at the floor tiles for his embassy if you're so inclined. A bit of media news. I think tonight was the night that George Norrie's new TV show premiered. As someone who's taping it for me, it's called The Unexplained, and it's on the Sci-Fi Network. And I saw the promo for it. Looked really good. I'm sure it'll be a hit for George and for Sci-Fi. Looks like NBC is jumping back into the UFO topic as well. NBC is asking for people to write in with their close encounter stories. Dateline, I guess, is working on a UFO show. So a couple of weeks ago, they started asking for people to send in their tales of UFOs and abductions. And I think you have to go to the MSNBC website to submit your story. But keep in mind, you know, every major network news program that we've seen about UFOs has really stunk up the joint. These news guys, they don't really like the topic. They always seem to flake out. They give the debunkers the last word. They make people look ridiculous. So if you're going to send these folks your story, proceed with caution. Okay, let's talk about the Needles UFO crash. I call it a UFO in the strictest sense of the word. It's unidentified. We don't know what this thing was. But back in May 14th, 3 o'clock in the morning, this large turquoise-like object flew out of the sky, coming from the northeast to the southwest. One of the eyewitnesses is Frank Costigan. He saw it fly over his house in Bullhead City. He was up letting his cat out, I think, at the time. Another key eyewitness was a fisherman on a houseboat who was floating down the Colorado River south of Needles, and he saw this thing crash just west of the Colorado River. Actually heard it land with a thump. And then within a couple of minutes, all these helicopters showed up and somehow attached this thing and carted it off into the sky, heading toward the north. Residents of the Needles area say that the next day, all these strange vehicles showed up, men with a military bearing sitting in these vehicles with the kind of blacked out windows. They were checking out the radio station, KTOX, for one thing. They showed up another day or two later to ask questions of some lady who'd been at the radio station when a particular witness had called in, and things were kind of weird. Well, we started hearing about this. We started chasing the story. And we also started hearing these stories about these weird trucks with blacked out windows from people who drive back and forth from Las Vegas to the Needles area. So as I told you last time I was here, my photographer and I started going down there and chasing it, looking for these guys, see if we could get lucky and find them. And we did. And I've been promising you that I'd tell you who this agency was, so here we go. So we're driving back from Needles. We just passed Laughlin, the turnoff to Laughlin, Nevada, heading back to Las Vegas. And my photographer sees a couple of these trucks go by. So we hang a UE, catch up to them. I'm shooting video with this little video camera. Get right up alongside of them, shoot the license plate. It says U.S. government. It's blacked out windows. The guy's inside. Quickly figure out that we're up to no good. So we can see him talking on a radio. And just before we get to Laughlin, there's a turnoff, a way station, and they pulled off. So we pulled off, jumped out of the truck, had the camera pointing it back in their direction. It was kind of like a little standoff there, like who's going to draw first. Pretty soon, after a couple of minutes, one of these trucks pulls up next to us. And now they've got us kind of surrounded, and two guys jump out. And one guy looked like he was tucking in weapons under his civilian shirt. And he demanded to see our ID, and I demanded to see his ID, and it was kind of tense for a while there. And pretty soon he whips out a badge, and here's what it said. It said NNSA, National Nuclear Security Administration, which I told the guy, hey, I know that agency. I work with the Nevada test site all the time. You must know, of our TV station, and you must have heard my name. These guys had no idea who I was, and they were not impressed one bit. Gave them my identification. They wrote it down. I'm thinking to myself, oh, boy, by the time I get back to Las Vegas, I'll probably have 10 years of my taxes have been audited, and I could be in big trouble. And the guy said, look, you're not in any trouble. You're not under arrest, but you need to stand away as we continue with our shipment. And I asked him, shipment? Shipment of what? He says, I can't answer any questions, but somebody's going to be in contact with you. I figured, oh, boy. Well, sure enough, I got a call from a friend of mine at the Department of Energy. He told me that, boy, you don't know how close you came. because these guys are not just NNSA, they're part of something, a sub-agency that I had never heard of before in all the years of covering the test site and government programs and government agencies. It's called the OST, the Office of Secure Transportation. And basically, these guys transport nuclear weapons. They move nuclear weapons back and forth whenever they have to be moved to be dismantled or reconfigured. And it's not entirely an unknown agency. It's not classified. Its existence is not a secret, although most of what it does is secret. And they recruit the best of the best. I mean, ex-military guys, special forces guys, some law enforcement. They train constantly. They travel in convoys of 8-9 vehicles at a time, a big truck to carry big devices, and then smaller trucks with support and weapons. And anyway, because I had run into them there, they flew a guy out to meet with me from New Mexico. We got to talking about it. They told me basically what they did. Among other things, they told me about these amazing vehicles that they use to transport the weapons. And wow, what a story it is. They, in essence, told me that these vehicles are capable of defending themselves. So in the event that all these heavily armed agents were somehow overcome by, say, a team of terrorists, these trucks would defend themselves. And they told me flat out that if somebody tried to take a nuclear device or nuclear weapon out of one of these trucks, that person would be dead, period. Although they wouldn't describe exactly what the technology was for how that would come about. Anyway, we got to meet the head of the agency. He flew out from Washington a couple of weeks later. They took us up to a training program that was underway at the Nevada test site. And we got a first ever TV news glimpse into this program and put the stories on KLAS-TV, which is where I work for my day job. But that doesn't end the mystery, because after we aired the story, my friends down there in Needles who'd been helping me, Frank Costigan and David Hayes at KTOX Radio, they looked at the vehicles that were in our reports and said, well, that's not quite exactly the ones that we saw. So anyway, joining me now to talk about both the men in black and about the original incident that set this thing off, Frank Costigan, who was chief of police at LAX, Los Angeles International Airport, for several years, and the guy we know affectionately as Houseboat Bob. Frank, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Frank, thanks for joining us. I appreciate all the help you've been giving to us on this story. And Bob, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Hey, Bob, let's start with you. Your name is not Bob, but could you tell me where the name Bob on the River came from?
Yes, sir. I basically didn't want to give out my real name. And what else do you call somebody that floats around on the river all day? Bob.
Okay. Frank, why don't you start to tell us, bring the recap for the audience, what you saw fly over your house, and then we'll go to what Bob saw or heard land next to the river.
Yeah, I went out to take care of my cat, who's my best friend, and about 3 in the morning. And I noticed all of a sudden the ground is getting a little bit lighter. And I thought, you know, is the moon moving or what? And I looked up and I saw something flying over. And it was looked to me like a meteorite or an asteroid, but extremely large, bright turquoise blue with a yellow, red, flame, orange, you know, behind it. This thing was monstrous. And it passed my house heading for the Colorado River. But I lost sight of it as it went behind the mountain. And it was so big, you know, and my background working at the L.A. Department of Airports for almost 20 years, I fully expected to hear a sonic boom or a crash or something. And I never heard anything. And I was kind of surprised at that.
And you've since found other people in your area who saw the thing as well.
Yes. And, you know, not only that, you know, Bob's going to tell you about his experience with it, but we've come across witnesses, and I talked to one several weeks ago and again last night, that report witnesses that, in addition to the helicopters, saw a military jet fighter circling in a big circle on the outer perimeter of where these helicopters were operating in the recovery of this thing.
And it appeared to you or to other witnesses that this thing was flying out of the sky, and it appeared to slow down and then speed up again.
Yeah, almost like, you know, if you're familiar with what a retro rocket is for slowing down or changing the airspeed of a rocket, it would indicate to me something of that order.
Okay, Bob, let's start in with your story, and we'll probably have to take a break, but let's get going on it. You're floating down the Colorado, 3 o'clock in the morning, you're fishing, and what happens?
Well, George, I was sitting on the front of my boat watching my lines. The entire front end of the boat lit up. It's like someone shined a spotlight on it. And I couldn't figure it out because it wasn't coming from anywhere. So I got up out from where I was sitting and went to the front, and I looked up, and there was this thing, bright, bright turquoise blue, green, and almost like it's hard to explain, but my first initial thought was, my God, it's a plane crash.
Hold on there, Bob. That song from Sheryl Crow tells us we need to take a break. I'm sorry the timing is not great, but we'll come right back and hear the rest of your story. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Something strange fell from the sky south of Needles, California, back on May 14th. The two most important eyewitnesses to that event are with us, are telling us what they saw. The man known as Bob on the River has resurfaced and is telling his story on the radio for the very first time, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back, and we'll try to save a few minutes for you to ask some questions of Bob and Frank Costigan as well here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our guests, Frank Costigan and Bob on the River. Bob, I know people won't believe I did that on purpose to cut you off at that point, but that's just the way it ended up. Continue with your story. You see this bright light bouncing off the water, right?
Well, it had reflected all around to the front of the boat, and I thought someone was shining a light on me, and but I didn't hear anything. I got up, like I said, and I went to the front of the boat, and I looked up, and that's when I saw it. And it only took a couple of seconds, maybe 3 or 4 seconds at the most, because by the time I could focus on it, it had already come over my head and proceeded to land about 100, 150 yards due west of my position. And I expected, like Mr. Costigan, I expected to hear a large crash, but all I heard was a thump. Kind of like if you put a big boulder down into the soft sand, thump, that kind of noise.
And, well, that whole area is sandy, isn't it?
It's sand and soft brush, but you got to understand, at 3 o'clock in the morning out here, it's extremely dark. You can't see much of anything except for the outlying lights way around towards where the cities are. But anyway, I honestly believed in my heart at that time it was a plane crash. I thought that's what I'd seen. I went back inside the cabin of the boat to find my cell phone. By the time I got my cell phone and turned it on, I tried to get a signal. I was unable to get a signal, even though there were bars present, but I tried dialing 911. It wouldn't go out. So I tried to get up on the top deck, went around the back. By the time I got up on the top deck, I barely got up there and was looking still over towards the area where I thought it had impacted, and that's when the first of the little helicopters showed up. And first one, then two, then three, then four altogether. Made a slow circle in a counterclockwise motion around kind of below my boat and then a little bit up farther to the north and then over towards where the crash site was. And I was amazed at this, still trying to get a phone signal out, when the big sky crane showed up. And you can't miss those. That thing was huge. And it came in the same direction, following the other four, and disappeared over the edge and behind the brush line.
The little ones are shining lights on you?
No. They came around and circled around and then disappeared, like I said, over towards the area where the impact point was. Now, I'm down on the river, and the banks go up a little bit of a ways, so I was down out of their line of sight. But I was standing on top of the boat when I saw they weren't down. They couldn't have been down more than 10 minutes because it took me a few minutes to get back down to the lower section of the boat. I figured it had to be a plane crash because they were already on it. Got back inside my boat, went back up to the front, was checking my lines and looking back over towards the area. And at that time, it couldn't have been more than 10 minutes at the very most. That's when the big hook appeared. The big helicopter came right back up. This thing was underneath it, and they disappeared to the northwest and out of my line of sight.
So you're not thinking it's a plane crash anymore, obviously.
I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a plane crash at the first. That's the initial feeling I had what it was.
The thing that was hauled away, how big was it?
It was a large, it appeared to be a large cylindrical-shaped tank. It looked like a tank. Meaning like a fluid tank, you know, not a army tank. I'm talking about a tank, like the size of a tanker truck.
And was it glowing or putting out any color?
It appeared to be reflecting somewhat because of the lights that the little helicopters were shining on it, but they weren't dolting on it. They were basically kind of, circling it, but not circling. It's hard to explain.
Well, they were shining lights that would occasionally reflect off of this thing?
Yes, that's how I got what it looked like.
So,
and they were gone instantly. I mean, I only had just this very few minutes. You know, this thing was out of sight. It impacted. They picked it up and flew off with it.
And flew away in kind of a formation?
The one small helicopter made one circle back around, shined his light down on my boat, sat there for maybe 5-10 seconds, and then followed the rest of them, and off they went.
Bob, you were, we'll get into this whole Men in Black thing in a minute, but for a while there, you know, I was trying to call you. Frank Costigan was trying to find you. We went down to the Topak Marina to find you. Nobody could find you. Were you, there was a lot of theories that maybe somebody had come and snatched you. Nobody came and snatched you, right?
No, not at all. I just didn't want to be found.
And, I don't want to go into your personal life too much, but, I mean, it's the kind of thing where you just didn't want attention.
Well, no, not so much that as I didn't know what this thing was. I have no idea. I still don't.
You know, when I've asked you about this before in the couple of times that we've met, you've been sort of cagey with me in terms of, you know, you don't think it was something we were meant to see and that that maybe you had heard something from somebody that it really was exotic. Can you elaborate?
George, the only thing I can tell is I had two visitors, and they weren't Men in Black. They were two people that showed up on my boat. Now, you've been aboard my boat. You know where it was parked.
Yep.
And you know how you have to walk down onto the dock to get to it. Well, when you're on my boat, you can feel anybody. You can feel a 5-year-old that walks along that dock. Anything. I mean, it's like a 6.5 factor earthquake and if somebody walks on the dock to come down to see the boat. And I had two people show up that were extremely unusual. Now, I thought they were there interested in buying the boat. But when I asked them to come in, and they wanted to come in and see the boat, they didn't want to look at the boat. They just sat there and looked at me. But it was a very unusual way these people appeared. And I don't want to take up your valuable time, but they were just extremely unusual. And they had heard the story, and they pretty much made it known to me that everything was okay. And that's just about what they said.
Everything was okay.
Everything was okay. It's nothing bad.
Did they tell you to be quiet or keep your mouth shut or you?
Not in so many words.
That's just an impression you got?
I definitely got that impression.
So that's why you were sort of having a low profile there for a while.
It kind of got my attention.
Yeah. they didn't identify themselves in any way? Did they look like military or government or?
No, absolutely the opposite. They looked like models out of Hollywood. It was a man and a woman, blonde hair. Bright blue eyes, just extremely attractive people. Very, very nice, very pleasant.
Wait a second. Are you hinting that maybe these people are from somewhere else?
I don't know. I have no idea. But they didn't act like someone that was looking at a boat to buy it.
Frank Costigan, these other strange people show up pretty quickly, and they're hanging around the radio station, checking out the radio station, according to you and Dave Hayes and some of the other folks there. You've seen the stories that we aired. Do you think that this is not the OST, that the guys who are looking at the station are not the same ones that we encountered out on the road?
I don't believe so. The appearance of the people are very similar, but the vehicles are totally different. They got government plates and they're dark and they're weird looking with the windows darkened out. But, you know, I had a discussion with Dave Hayes while we were on the air. We ran your show, as we watched it. And we had a big discussion on the air that these were not the vehicles. His were the one he saw, the main one, was very high, off-road type of vehicle. And, we studied what you'd sent or put out on the air, and he says nothing matched what they had seen.
Well, the OST vehicles that we saw, they have a whole array of them. So, I'm going to have to probably go over that with you guys to see if any of them meet the description. Bob and Frank, both of you, tell me this. How have your lives changed since this thing happened? I mean, is it still a big story down there? You still get people asking you about it, seeking you out?
Yeah, all the time. In fact, you know, Dave is in a rock group, and they had an appearance Saturday, and I went down there with them. And there must have been 10 people come up and talk to me and to Dave while this was going on about that story. That everybody wants to go out and see it. They want more information. They're watching what you're putting out. And, you know, we advise them to listen tonight.
And, Bob, what about for you?
Well, the only thing that's different is that the owner of the property where my boat is moored had me move the boat to an inaccessible place.
Really?
Yes.
So that you don't have to deal with well-wishers or tourists or people who wish you ill.
Well, actually, I don't really believe it has anything to do with that, sir. I believe it's just because they're rebuilding the docks.
Okay. Well, you know, our for the benefit of the audience, we all went out on the boat, on your boat, and tried to find the spot. And we got it sort of narrowed down to a general area, but it's going to take a heck of an effort, isn't it, to find the exact impact point?
Well, I think yes, Frank. I think it is. It's pretty rugged territory out there. And, you know, I've had several people wanting us to take them out to that area, or four-wheel drive and a Jeep club are all interested in it. And we're getting calls all the time about it. And,
maybe you should start a tour business.
Well, what we did is set up a website to keep our lines here at this radio station clear because, you know, we need it for other things. Anybody that's interested in talking to anybody involved in it, we can make contact for you if you want to give that website.
Go ahead. What is it?
It's Needles Crash Site at live.com.
Okay. Bob, how has your life changed? I mean, is it, I know the UFO hunters came looking for you, right?
Yes, and Bill Burns and the gentleman that were with him, his crew, they're very, very pleasant people, very thorough. Very decent. We went out. We tried to locate pretty much the general area where I believe the crash site is located. You have to keep in mind, George, this was 3 o'clock in the morning, and the river kind of tends a lot to look a lot like the whole river, especially when it's dark. But I have pretty much narrowed it down to about a 4-square-mile area.
Right. And it's some tough territory, salt cedar. And I'll tell you what, we're going to take a couple of calls. Are you okay for that?
Certainly.
All right. Going to go to our international line, Billy in Toronto. How you doing, Billy?
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
What's your question?
The question that I have is for your guests. This UFO that they're describing, it sounds like it could be a possibility of a downed military satellite, possibly Chinese. From the description that your guest gave Bob, the riverboat Bob, it was a round cylinder size shape, size of a oil tanker. Do you think it might have been a satellite crashing down?
Well, we've discussed that. You guys can go ahead and take a stab at it. But, yeah, we've discussed that as being a pretty likely possibility, a satellite or a UAV or something like that. Wow. Any thoughts there, Frank, Bob?
Yeah, Bob's phone went dead. You're going to have to recontact him.
Okay.
What I saw, he talked about the tank shape. And I saw the shape, it appeared to be maybe six times longer than it was wide and rounded on the front end, you know, which you know, is similar to his description.
Yeah, the fact, Billy, your question, the fact that the military helicopters were there so quickly suggests that they were involved in this operation, whatever it was, or had been tracking it and were nearby. We had obtained some information from a scanner device that they're we detected a transponder for a military helicopter, an Army helicopter that was in that area at that exact time. A satellite, a UAV, that's a distinct possibility. We're going to go to east of the Rockies, Glenn in Texas. How you doing, Glenn? Hello?
Hello.
How you doing? What's your question?
Thank you. I'm doing just fine, Mr. Knapp. I didn't realize the object had such volume. It opens up a whole can of worms. My initial question was if it maneuvered any coming in, but something that size is incredible. It could have been a parachute.
I don't know. Is Bob back with us?
Yeah, he's
yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Bob, did you see a parachute or anything like that?
I did not see anything like a parachute. The only thing that I noticed, and I only had just a brief few seconds to view this thing before it impacted, but it as much as I ran it over and over in my mind, I could have swore it was slowing down. No parachute was visible in any way, shape, or form. But it something that was that large and was coming that fast and just thumped or, you know, barely bounced. No parachute, nothing. It was almost like it was slowing down.
You, when it hit, I mean, you heard a thump. Did you see any kind of debris fly off the thing?
It was hard to tell about. I didn't see any of that. What I saw was sand and dust being blown up from the rotor wash of the little choppers.
Right. Because I know when we went out on your boat, the boat, even on the top, it's below the level of the where this thing would have hit.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you for the call there, Glenn. We're going to go west of the Rockies, George in Utah. How you doing, George?
I'm doing good tonight, guys. How you doing?
Okay. What's on your mind?
Well, like I told your call screener, I've had the experience of actually working with the Men in Black, and I can tell you that the capabilities of those delivery trailers is something you don't want to mess with.
You mean these OST guys?
Yeah, the vehicle that I know is actually called an SST. They call it a safe, secure transport, and it does have defensive measures to keep someone from getting that weapon.
Yeah, I was very impressed by these guys myself, but it sounds like from the descriptions of Frank and other witnesses that maybe those OST guys that I encountered are not the ones who were spying on the radio station and everything. But thank you for your call there, George. Other thoughts, Bob, on what happened? Do you think you're ever going to know what this thing was?
Well, I sure hope so, George. I'd sure like to know. I'm just glad there are other people coming forward that are other witnesses, so we can cooperate and, you know, maybe get to the bottom of it. Honestly speaking, I have a good feeling that it's okay. Whatever it is, it's okay.
And Frank, where does the investigation go from here? You're using your cop instincts to chase down a lot of leads. What other leads do you need to follow up on?
Well, you know, there's people still coming forward, you know, and new bits of information. And, you know, you and I and your cameraman went out there and walked the ground in the area. It's pretty tough stuff. And, you know, I still think we need to explore that, you know, or your listeners can do that and contact us. And I'm sure that you'd give them the time if they found something.
Well, we posted our stories at the website of the TV station where I work, LasVegasNow.com. People can watch it, and we've got a GPS coordinates there if people want to start a search. But I'll tell you, it'd take an army of people to go out there and look around. And even if there was something that fell off that thing that Bob saw, you could have had an army of people who went in there and already cleaned it up, and no one would have ever been able to see them. I mean, you could have a whole, wouldn't you agree, Bob? You could have a whole bunch of people out there, and no one would see them.
Not only do I agree, but there at the restaurant there where I park my boat, we have witnesses. The waitress that was working there, maybe two or three weeks ago, she happened to be working there. She knows about this story. She came to me and told me that one of her customers happened to mention, yeah, she was part of the cleanup crew.
Really?
Well, I haven't heard about that.
Did she say what it was she was cleaning up?
Yeah, the crash site.
I mean, what would say what the object was that crashed?
Nope, didn't say anything about that. They just mentioned that they were out there assigned to clean up the crash site.
And
the
since
whole crew
these
came in and had lunch in the restaurant and went back out.
Since these two people showed up on your boat with the bright blue eyes, any other strange characters hanging around?
Well, it'd be kind of hard to tell where I live.
Okay. Isn't it odd, Frank Costigan, that there's you know, the night before the UFO Hunters TV show is supposed to come there and talk to Bob, there's a big fire, and it burns right up to the edge of the Topak Marina where Bob had his boat.
It is, you know, to the point that he had to evacuate his boat from the area. But, you know, there was on some of these websites, people, you know, a little bit concerned or trying to stop any further investigation. Not knowing where the actual crash site is, you know, to me it's very suspicious that a fire breaks out and burns for a week and, you know, a firefighter dies and it's right there at the same place, but it's just happened to be on the wrong side of the river.
Yeah, if someone was trying to destroy the trail of evidence or confuse it or, you know, hide it, that might be something they'd try, but they tried the wrong spot.
That's true.
Okay.
The other, The other interesting thing, real quick, is that when the UFO hunters were in my at my yard filming, and everybody knew that they were going to be there, two military helicopters flew over in formation real slow right over my yard.
They Frank Costigan and Houseboat Bob, thanks for joining us. It was a fascinating discussion, and we'll have you back on again sometime. And coming up in a couple of minutes, Richard Dolan. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.